My name is Patrick Fellaquet. I am a British Academy postdoctoral fellow in music at the University of Edinburgh, and I would like to welcome you to this roundtable discussion of the book Composing Capital, Classical Music in the Neoliberal Era, published by University of Chicago Press in 2019. I'm very pleased to have had two guests with me to discuss the book. The first voice you will hear is that of Dr. Anna Bull, who is a senior lecturer in the School of Education and Sociology at the University of Portsmouth. Anna is co-founder of the 1752 Group, consulting on sexual harassment in higher education, and was lead author of their report Silencing Students in 2018. Her first monograph is entitled Class, Control, and Classical Music, and was published by Oxford University Press in 2019. The second voice you will hear is that of Dr. Simone Kruger-Bridge, who is reader in music in the Department of Sociology at Liverpool John Moores University. Simone has authored and edited several books, including the most recent Trajectories and Themes in World Popular Music, Globalization, Capitalism, Identity, which was published by Equinox in 2018. The conversation you will hear is edited from a Zoom call that I conducted with Anna and Simone at the beginning of October 2020. First, you will hear 10-minute commentaries from each of us in turn. Then you will hear roughly 15 minutes of question and answer, where we discuss key themes that we identified in the book. After that, you will hear a response to our conversation, which was recorded at the end of November 2020 by Mariana Ritchie herself. Mariana is Associate Professor in Music History at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and I'm very, very grateful for her generosity in agreeing to respond to us. Before we begin, then, I would like to thank all of my co-contributors again, and I would like to thank Dr. Sarah Collins, who is review editor for RMA Research Chronicle, and it was Sarah who invited me to convene this conversation.
I really enjoyed reading this book, and I was really fascinated by the case studies that Ritchie discusses, as well as the wider arguments that she draws out from them. And it's wonderful to see such an ambitious argument being made. And there was a lot of intersection with some of the things I've been thinking about over recent years. And I'm going to focus on two of the key concepts from the book, genre and autonomy, as these concepts really jumped out at me as being interesting contributions that she makes. So first of all, I'll start with genre. Now, I find it really interesting that she names classical music as a category and she uses that label. And until fairly recently, of course, it was normal to talk about Western art music, but many more people are now using the term classical music, including sociologists such as myself and Christina Schaff. And I use this term because it's the vernacular term that the young musicians in my research used when they were talking about the music that they were making. But I think it's really important that she names it. This naming does important work in relocating classical music in the cultures that produce and consume it, and in doing this, moving beyond universalist discourses, recognising that this is a genre that's located in particular cultures, times and spaces. And Ritchie specifies that she's talking specifically about the US context. But although she names the genre, she doesn't actually define classical music. And that's clearly a move that she makes on purpose. She states that the book examines classical music, and I quote, as an idea and a conveyor of certain values that may help shape contemporary capitalism, unquote. So she's primarily examining the discourses around classical music, but she does also discuss the musical qualities of some of the works she's talking about, as well as musical practices such as labour market practices. But in fact, actually, many of her chapters discuss contemporary classical music rather than, you know, the canon, or what I might call the bread and butter of classical music and its education, its repertoire, its socialities, its institutional contexts. So one question I have that we might return to later, perhaps, is whether her argument is primarily about new music or contemporary classical music rather than classical music more broadly speaking. But certainly, as she points out, the discourses of classical music as universal and timeless are doing a lot of work to legitimise late capitalism or neoliberalism. But the actual music she's writing about is new music. And an interesting example to demonstrate these discussions about genre in the contemporary classical music scene is the argument and the scene she focuses on in chapter two, which is the so-called indie classical scene in the US. And that's my cat adding some musical meows to the background. So this is a site that grew up in Brooklyn from 2007, and it describes a group of classical musicians who've championed a particular kind of entrepreneurial DIY ethos. And Richie points out various contradictions within the ways these musicians describe themselves. They argue that they're doing something radical, but they rely on grants or institutional fellowships or prestigious connections with institutions in their work. They draw on a neoliberal rhetoric of competition and disruption, but they reject the idea that music can or should do anything socially or politically. So this chapter sits in dialogue in interesting ways with Christina Scharf's book on early career female freelance classical musicians in London and Berlin. And Christina actually argues that classical musicians, particularly female classical musicians, epitomise the neoliberal worker, seeing themselves as the product that they are marketing. And as she and others have also pointed out, the gig economy takes not only its language, but also its employment model from, you know, musical labour historically and today, where freelance gigging musicians have been the norm for much longer than neoliberalism has been around. And Christina's book focuses on subjectivity, musician subjectivities, and argues that classical musicians exemplify the subjectivity of neoliberalism in that they themselves are the product. They have to hide any injuries or faults. They have to disavow inequalities to pretend they live in a world of perfect competition. So I think these wider debates from the sociology of creative labour are helpful in contextualising Richie's arguments. And where's the link that I want to make between kind of genre theory and these points? So Richie rightly kind of points out the fact that these musicians are coming primarily from privileged backgrounds. And she also describes how this group of artists argue that they are working outside genre or beyond genre. And this for me is a really crucial point that I think situates them within classical music even more strongly than ever. So I've suggested in my book that we can theorise genres, musical genres, as forming what you might call an articulation or a contingent connection with social groups. And you can explore the social identity categories of the musicians and the audiences that produce and consume a particular genre. So I see classical music as having an articulation with the middle classes historically and today. And I suggest that if we make genre visible by naming it and describing it, and we make visible its links with social groups, that makes it harder to make these beyond genre arguments. So when these contemporary classical musicians that Richie's talking about, when they argue that they're beyond genre, they're also arguing that they're somehow kind of outside of the social and they're disavowing their privilege. And I'm really curious to hear more about kind of their background and how they've got to the privileged positions as cultural labourers that they have got to. So to say that you're outside genre is to say that you're outside of social identity categories, that you're a genius whose music is a universal language that exists outside of time and space. And as Richie points out, this also disavows the institutional structures of classical music education and funding that has supported these musicians in establishing their careers. So you can see that genre, there's a lot to be explored around that concept here. But a linked concept that I want to explore is autonomy. And this is one of the main concepts that Richie explores throughout her book, particularly discussing in the conclusion. And she defines autonomy in classical music as autonomy from the market and from market forces. So building on earlier arguments that classical music is a space of resistance to capitalism, because of this autonomy from the market, or rather this autonomy from the market means it is possible for classical music to resist capitalism. And this definition of autonomy is actually a bit different to the one that sociologists such as Georgina Bourne and myself have used. So the idea of autonomy that I've drawn on from Georgina Bourne is that classical music claims an autonomy from any associations with the social at all. It disavows social significations entirely. It's not just seeing itself as autonomous from the market and from capitalism, but from the social more generally. And this is really important, this distinction between the two definitions, because this, for Ritchie, autonomy from the market means that there is a space for critique, or potentially. But if we see autonomy as being from any social significations or social location, then it works against progressive social change. So in my book, I've documented how for young people playing in classical music ensembles in the south of England, the idea that classical music transcends the social and the bodily, or it's autonomous from the social and the bodily, means that it reproduces classed and gendered forms of oppression, both through its text and its social relations. Now, there is a middle ground between these two definitions of autonomy articulated by Lucy Green, a music education writer, and she suggests that critical capacities can be made available by music and reception. So, you know, that Ritchie's position is a possible one that you can take, but cautions against making any assumption about how music is understood by others. So you can't read autonomy onto musical texts, but instead you have to look at how texts become social practices. And Ritchie does do this. She looks at the social practices around the music making as well as looking at the text itself. And I think a real strength is that she combines these two approaches. And so through this method, she's exploring the ways in which contemporary classical music and the case studies in her book is complicit with and entangled with late capitalist markets in various ways. And she concludes by being quite positive about the idea of autonomy as creating, or as having the possibility of creating, a non-commodified space and therefore a space for critique. And I do agree that it can create a non-commodified space, but I would suggest that creating a non-commodified space in classical music isn't necessarily going to be a space for progressive change. So in the sites in my book, I found that even though there certainly was some level of autonomy from capitalism, there often wasn't space for critique despite this autonomy. So classical music's autonomy just as often creates an apolitical space that looks to the past, to heritage and preservation discourses, rather than a space that is actively autonomous from capitalism. And so whether these two spaces can ever overlap is an interesting question. And overall, I'd ask whether this denial of the social, so not just denial of the market, but denial of the social more widely, surely can serve capitalism by, for example, obscuring the material conditions of production of the music, obscuring the social relations of music making. So I wonder whether classical music's idea that it is autonomous, in fact, makes it less able to resist being co-opted by capital and by capitalism. And there's a lot more I could say. I loved her arguments about innovation, and I was also really fascinated by the discussions of flexibility and specialism. But I will wrap up there and pass over to Simon.
Thank you, Patrick, for the invitation to review this very important book. Overall, Mariana Ritchie presents a richly nuanced critique, or in fact, two types of critique, of the neoliberalization of classical music, the artistic critique and the social critique, while on the one hand revealing neoliberal values of multiculturalism and urban renewal, entrepreneurialism and competitive individualism, technological innovation and human creativity, and on the other highlighting social injustices and inequalities, violence, mass displacement and gentrification, labour precarity, commodification and labour intensification, surveillance dystopia and drone warfare. Ritchie positions herself as a stern critique of the neoliberalization of the autonomous ideal that is autonomous from the market, or of neoliberal radical individualism. She argues that in neoliberal capitalism, the autonomous ideal itself has been co-opted by neoliberal capitalism to ultimately serve capital. She exemplifies her argument through four extended case studies on contemporary male classical artists, whose institutional successes and widespread critical acclaim is the very result of their non-anti-capitalist ideas. Yet, in my review here, I would like to focus more on the social critique of capitalism. The social critique essentially has something to do with identity, inequality, and difference in capitalism. which is constructed on the basis that, quote, capitalism is not only founded on, but actively requires some degree of systematized inequality to function successfully as a system, end quote. Ricci refers to the feminist Marxist Silvia Federici, who argued throughout her whole career that, quote, race, class, and gender-based inequalities are ongoing requirements of capitalism, end quote. Ricci particularly talks about new musicology, which somewhat ignored the social critique and often affirmed difference as empowering, which, quote, inadvertently reaffirmed the universal character of capitalism, end quote, rather than actually challenging it. Difference is never opposing to capitalism itself, and is used to, quote, propagate the fiction that capitalism generates equality and justice, end quote. Consequently, the book analyzes classical music or some examples of contemporary classical music within capitalism to consider how difference works in terms of race and class, whereby it is worth noting that there is less focus on gender and sexuality in her book. Such discussions of identity, inequality, and difference in capitalism resonate, for example, with Robin James' 2015 book about patriarchy and resilience in neoliberalism, who argues that given that neoliberal ideology conceives of everything in economic terms, this has changed how gender and race work. In neoliberalism, the old binary divisions that were used to regulate, objectify, and exclude have gradually been replaced by the apparent acceptance of all sorts of differences, at least at the surface, in what she describes as the, quote, the new, supposedly more diverse, tolerant, and progressive, post-racial, post-feminist mainstream, end quote. Yet, post-racialism, post-feminism, post-classism, etc., are neoliberal myths. James coins the concept of multiracial white supremacist patriarchy to replace bell hooks' white supremacist capitalist patriarchy and to describe 21st century globalized Western race, gender, sexuality, capitalist hegemony. I similarly show in my book, through numerous examples of global popular music, the way that masculinity and femininity, or particular forms of these, are co-opted and commodified by the neoliberal creative and music industries. So, an example then of the commodification of difference that promotes these fictions of equality and justice is presented in chapter one on the work of contemporary American composer Mason Bates, whom she describes as a heroic figure and who is said to be saving classical music's perceptions as outdated, elitist, sexist, and racist by fusing it with neoliberal values like technical innovation, ethnic diversity, and corporate-driven social connectivity, which the chapter explores in quasi-chronological order. Richard talks about the way in which people like Bates or art music composers and performers more generally are nowadays patronized by wealthy corporations, such as the Cisco-funded performance of The Rise of Exotic Computing in 2014, and that this corporate power over art deliberately aligns itself with liberating, democratic, innovative, inclusive, and communal values. So on one hand, it could be argued indeed that the use of innovative technology opens the age gap by drawing in younger audiences. Yet, the typical rhetoric of bringing people together while promoting, at least on the surface, the what she calls, quote, superiority of democratic collectivity to elitist isolation, end quote. It's more than just about identities marked by age alone, but also by race and gender and so on. Ritchie concludes that since Bates' version of collectivity is wholly mediated by the market, it is merely a hollow one. In this context, Ritchie also refers to class. Technological change has been a feature of capitalism since modernity, with the current buzzword, of course, being technological innovation. And this has consequences for equality and justice in terms of class. Technological innovation in neoliberal capitalism reinforces de-skilling, labor mobility, and free labor among the working classes. In other words, deregulation, which are desirable working conditions for the accumulation of capital. And of course, the emergent gig economy means that, quote, workers must be flexible in leaping from job to job and adapting new skill sets so as to compete in a variety of labour markets, end quote. The culture and creative industries are a prime example of this. In the British context, Angela McRobbie made an important contribution with her 2015 book, Be Creative, Making a Living in the New Culture Industries, which shows how the encouragement to foster one's creativity as a set of capacities or skills necessary for professional success is entwined with the rise in freelance, temporary, and low-paid labour, and thereby advocates understanding creative labour as precarious work. So essentially, homeworking, part-time and temporary work, job sharing, subcontracting, etc., all serve the power-holding classes to unload social security payments while reinforcing racial and gendered inequalities via the ethnicization of global capitalism, given that CEOs, owners, directors, etc., are predominantly male and white. Ritchie shows that these neoliberal values, enabled by technological innovation, are evident, for example, in the YouTube Symphony Orchestra project, initiated by Google in 2006. In whose inaugural concert Mason Bates performed as an invited guest soloist. She notes in particular that the project relied entirely on unpaid internships and subcontracting. Another example of class-based and racial inequality and injustice is discussed in Chapter 3, which presents the example of a mobile opera in 24 cars in LA's Boyle Heights and highlights the opera's neoliberal contradictions through the lens of gentrification and LA's car culture. These have reinforced racial segregation and disenfranchise of working class African American and Latinx areas. So to Ritchie, the opera represents the class and race divide prevalent in LA. She describes how audience members were invited to look at neighborhoods and locations to appreciate their diversity and art. By the way, she doesn't talk about Uri's tourist gaze, which could have been quite interesting in this context. Yet in doing so, the project, in her words, quote, inadvertently aestheticized and glorified the processes of gentrification that are currently displacing many working class and minority communities from some of the areas the opera was meant to celebrate, end quote. Ritchie suggests that not engaging critically with the ambivalence of gentrification, the opera project, quote, simply foregrounded inequality by aestheticizing the artist's colonization of blighted areas. End quote.
Simone spoke quite a lot about inequality and immobility in contrast with neoliberal discourses of equality and mobility. And what was interesting for me was how projects that are nominally about deregulation and fragmentation have this undercurrent of institutional support and really a broad network of institutions that play a huge role in making sure that these things continue in the way that they're continuing. So that the neoliberal idea that everyone becomes an individual, I mean, the way that things play out puts the lie to that constantly. I was going through the chapter on the hopscotch and just made a list of all of the institutions that I found mentioned in that chapter. And there was everything from neighborhood organizations to art galleries, museums, the state of California, the city of Los Angeles, various authorities for traffic and housing, the MacArthur Foundation, and also various grassroots activist collectives, and then also all of the organizations that the musicians were involved in. And so all of these organizations, all of these sort of these non-individuals are working together to make sure that people are individualized. And it really contrasts with the technological personalization that is in the foreground of neoliberal reform. The things like iPads and Google Glasses in the museum, and this normalization of fragmentation and polarization and worker displacement that we see both in things like the opera Hopscotch, and in the experience that has forced us all to be remote from each other today, the lockdown configuration is afforded by neoliberal personalization technology. So it's interesting to see this, the way that this is in contrast with individualization. These things are actually really, really complex and hugely powerful formations that are beyond individuality that are making this possible. Another thing that struck me about the chapter on Hopscotch is the close relationship historically between neoliberalism and deindustrialization. In the 60s and 70s, when countries like France and Belgium and the UK are bringing their armies out of Africa, you get the image in the colonizing countries that deindustrialization is a process of industrial capital moving out, when in fact what's going on is industrial capital is being deployed to do the job that armies used to do. And then gradually factories are filled with artists, art replaces industry in inner cities, and the working classes are gradually fragmented and individualized. That process is really what Richard Florida's 2002 book, The Rise of the Creative Class, is sort of trying to turn on its head and make into something that managers can then get a grip on. And then there are also various ways that this has implications for people today. I mean, it plays out in all these different ambivalent forms of urbanism and ambivalent forms of engagement with the urban for artists. I was reminded of when I lived in the Netherlands, and to replace the widespread squatting that happened in the 1970s and 80s, in the Netherlands they have a thing called anti-crack, which is real estate companies recruiting artists to move officially into vacant buildings on temporary contracts so that squatters don't move in. For me, it was interesting because it led to this culture of informal underground events happening in these vacant spaces, under which was the possibility that any day they would be sent away and that they were actually under contract to go away when they were told. I found that really interesting. So this is not a uniquely American thing, and it plays out in different ways in different places. And it plays out in ways that are contradictory and have different implications depending on the perspective that you look at them from. I also was interested in how many precedents there were for the kinds of industry-sponsored, collaborative, participatory art that she wrote about. In the chapters, specifically the chapter on the use of Beethoven in the Intel advertising event, and also in the chapter on hopscotch, I was constantly reminded of Robert Rauschenberg's work with Bell Labs and Pepsi and BMW in the 60s and 70s. And these were massive projects like Nine Evenings, which brought together experimental music and sort of happenings and conceptual art brought together in the service of commerce. And these things aren't really inseparable from each other. And the idea of knowledge transfer being a product of art comes out of this time. And even there in the team of composers behind Hopscotch, I noticed David Rosenboom, who would have been involved in these first generation projects. So it didn't always seem to me that I could make a clear break between the moment when these practices were authentic and politically critical and the moment when they are when they become co-opted. It seemed to me that that runs, if you look at the history, it actually runs together. While there was a lot of mentions of this sort of privatization of the public sphere, and there were also mentions of the aesthetic concept of immersion, those two things didn't really get pushed together very much. Boltanski's idea that this is the spirit of capitalism really folds in the shifting idea of justifications coming back to recuperate things that capitalism had lost to criticism over time. And in that regard, it would have been really interesting to see more attention to May 68 and the appropriation of radical Marxist concepts and the factions that whose work in France leads to the first sort of neoliberal wave of cultural policy, which comes with Mitterrand in 1981. And that, interestingly, is a socialist government. A lot of this theory has a much older history and links back to 19th century liberalism. So neoliberalism as a sort of school of economics is linked back to economic theory at the University of Vienna, particularly the students of Karl Menger. We should talk, I think, more about Friedrich Hayek, whose work has been particularly important in the UK, particularly through the Institute of Economic Affairs, of which Thatcher was a prominent supporter, and whose supporters today include people like Michael Gove, Liz Truss, Preeti Patel, Dominic Raab, of course, the late Roger Scruton wrote things on behalf of the Institute of Economic Affairs. But the interesting thing also is that this school of economics was also important in the theorization of the knowledge economy. Fritz Machlup, who was a student of economics at the University of Vienna and then moved to the States in the 50s, first theorized knowledge production as an economic activity. His work influenced the work of Daniel Bell, and Daniel Bell also had theorized sort of ends of ideology and racism and class around the same time. But the final point I want to make is that Daniel Bell's work is what François Lyotard in The Postmodern Condition is responding to. The Postmodern Condition was written as a report for the Quebec government's education ministry in 1979. On the impact of computer networks on the university system. And what Lyotard is trying to do is trying to theorize what do we do with the concepts of truth and equality and what do we do with morality when everything is leveled and everything is accessible. Oh, don't cry. Oh, don't I thought it was interesting when I was reading the fourth chapter, the musician whose work is used in the Intel ad, Kawehi, who is a Hawaiian woman who's working on a digital audio workstation and who figures as the sort of ideal neoliberal individual. And it struck me that she was not, as far as I could tell, making classical music. So what is going on here? What is the classical doing for Ritchie, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think she rightly identifies the fact that classical music discourses of timelessness and universality are helpful for large corporations under neoliberalism. They give them a kind of a history and a kind of a respect, a legitimization maybe historically and morally, most importantly, that they would otherwise lack. But really, in terms of the music itself, she's not talking about classical music as I would identify the genre. She is talking about contemporary classical music because, and she has this focus on innovation throughout, and rightly identifying innovation as a kind of imperative of neoliberalism, and finding that there is a symbiosis between that kind of imperative towards innovation and critiques of classical music, or rather people who've reacted against classical music, arguing it needs to change, it needs to innovate. So she's rooted in she's writing about musicians and music who are rooted in classical music institutions, but the music they are making is characterized by this by particular types of innovation. And she identifies kind of musical characteristics to these types of innovation as well. But I didn't see any of the kind of continuity of classical music. There wasn't much of the repertoire where there was repertoire, the Beethoven fifth Intel ad. It's not played as we would recognize classical music. So the name is, the name is essential to identify the discourses, but I think in terms of the music, she's talking more about contemporary classical music.
Yeah, I agree. I'd also suggest that the musical examples she chose for the book have been updated to reflect the current neoliberal structure of feeling or market zeitgeist. And I would perhaps describe them as neoliberal classical music. For me, the examples are classical in the context of contemporary classical music. What sprung to mind was that they could possibly be part of the avant-garde or experimental music or electronic contemporary music, as they share similarities and are all innovative in terms of the technologies that these artists are using. So in that respect, the examples are contemporary classical music. However, they're just one type of contemporary classical music. What I found missing was a more representative palette of musical examples, and to acknowledge other types of contemporary classical music that are neoliberalized. What springs to mind, for instance, is the hugely commercially successful violinist and conductor André Rieu, who could be thoroughly described as neoliberal, while performing a sort of soft or pop classical music. He turned classical and waltz music into a worldwide concert touring act and is as successful as some of the biggest global pop and rock music acts. Yet Rieu is neoliberal in a different way than the artists presented in the book. He is uncool even, by presenting a sort of historically rooted, glossy or kitsch version of classical music. Ritchie's artists are cool, similar to current hip-hop or post-feminist artists in popular music, or the Saatchi brothers or Andy Warhol in art culture. Yet even so, Rieu similarly reflects neoliberal values of individuality, entrepreneurialism, technological innovation, human creativity, and elite-centered multiculturalism.
There's a realm of coolness that she's dealing with that is not... She's very careful not to let it... overlap too much with what she obviously sees as sort of authentic
avant-garde. I guess I tried to get at this a little bit, like the idea that there was once authenticity and we've lost that. She uses the term perverted, which I found really interesting, that the authentic avant-garde has been perverted by capitalism. Go on, Simone. Yeah.
I agree. And to ask questions about what makes the contemporary classical artist neoliberal is probably the key question to be asked. And I found an answer in a passage that she actually wrote very early on in the book, on page 3, where she says that these are clearly classical artists whose institutional successes and widespread critical acclaim is a result of their non-anti-capitalist ideas. She actually describes them as being against the modernist spirit of critique.
It seems to me that modernism is at the front of her definition, and the critical power of modernism is at the front of her definition. It was clear to me that there's a blurry definition of composing, but in what ways is it blurred? Does that matter? Are we using composing the same way we're using classical music as a signifier of history and authority?
I certainly think that it varies from chapter to chapter. Although, to my mind, the emphasis of Ritchie's analysis is more on performing and experiencing, so audience perception. There are, of course, Susan McClary-esque music theoretical analyses interspersed throughout, where she is trying to read neoliberalism or neoliberal features in the actual music itself, which shed light into compositional aspects on the one hand, as well as semiotic meanings constructed through those compositional techniques. Even so, I'd say her main focus is on the life or recorded performances of the projects presented in the book.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I guess, the distinction between the performer and the composer, you know, is at the heart of the genre of classical music, or at least you could argue that. Certainly Christopher Small, Lydia Gurr's, you know, work on classical music as a genre, which, people don't define it, by the way. Whenever genre as a term is used in relation to classical music, it's used in relation to subgenres such as, the sonata or the waltz or the symphony or whatever. So if she is kind of blurring the distinction between performer or composer, I would suggest that that's shifting the boundaries of classical music as a genre towards contemporary classical music, perhaps.
I was really interested in the use of the term experience. Of course, you have, so in the project Hopscotch, I think there were 6 composers in the end. And also the way that it was performed was meant to include sort of unintentional performers. And so it seemed to me that they were trying to shift the focus there, even from composing and from production to experience, at the level of production. It wasn't, the piece itself was supposed to be just a collage of experiences. That shift to experience seems to me maybe like paradigmatically neoliberal. And it's definitely a part of the way neoliberalism has been theorized. If we move to the reading of Capital, she's using the term cultural and, I believe, social capital once or twice, but not referencing Bourdieu. Simone, yeah.
Yes, indeed. Bourdieu doesn't feature much in the book, even though I read the title Composing Capital in a Bourdieuian sense. Cultural capital has, of course, shifted since Bourdieu's famous study. So while cultural capital in the 1960s and 70s was expressed through knowledge of the fine art and conferred prestige upon the knower, today's cultural capital confers, and I'm quoting Tim Taylor, quote, knowledge of the hip and the cool, end quote. Knowledge of the hip and the cool is the source of culture capital today. And what drives the cultural industries is the production of the hip and the cool. In terms of cultural production, workers frequently use the term edgy to describe the sort of work that they want to produce, which it is hoped will be thought of as hip or cool by consumers. And in this context, Jim McGuigan makes an important argument that neoliberal capitalism is cool capitalism. So the hip, cool and edgy is the new cultural logic of neoliberal capitalism. And the examples in the book clearly demonstrate this. So it strikes me that Ritchie is clearly drawing on those ideas without making these connections.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, I saw her as using capital in the Marxist sense in the title rather than in the Bourgeoisian sense. But the critique that you draw on around cultural capital, you know, does kind of bring out some of the contradictions in this. So Tim Taylor, of course, was writing in the American context, but more recent work in, internationally actually, has looked at this idea of emerging cultural capital. And, you know, empirically it does seem that classical music and high culture still has value as a form of cultural capital. And as some authors have described it, there is still hierarchy among the omnivores, with high culture, including classical music, still retaining a form of value. But I think this question that you brought up of to what extent does classical music still carry cultural capital, and in what circumstances, and what does it do as a form of capital, I think is an interesting one to pose in relation to this book, because despite the fact she's arguing that the hip and the cool is part of how classical music is being composed as a form of capital, she's then still arguing that classical music has these legitimizing discourses that that neoliberalism needs. So yeah, there's a bit of a contradiction there that I don't think she comes down necessarily on one side or the other.
Again, we talked earlier about reinstating the value of classical music as a form of modernist critique. Anna, you talked about the separate, like, autonomy from the social as such, as the source of classical music's power, or that this ideology is behind the way modernist classical music sort of frames itself. What I found would have been really interesting would have been to think then about, and where personally I think a degree of kind of modernist critique is today valuable and relevant, is in relation to academic work specifically, and the work of musicologists and the work of academic music departments in disseminating economic discourses amongst students, in modeling certain kinds of behavior to students. And as people who work in some of the most highly neoliberalized institutions in the countries where we live, we, I think, have a responsibility to look at neoliberalism specifically in one of the most central classical music professions, which is the profession of the musicologist. So I, as always, encourage a more situated critique.
Yeah, just briefly, I appreciate her exploring the options for what an alternative would look like. I think that's a brave thing to do as a scholar. She didn't need to do that in the book. And even just attempting to do that, I think, is a helpful exploration. And, recognising that we're all always complicit to a greater or slightly lesser extent with neoliberal capitalism, and just even asking where are the spaces where there might be a little more space for expression outside of that, and perhaps thinking about musical practices and interactions, thinking about spaces of collectivity that might be different. So I guess, having made my critique of her definition of autonomy, I think I still think that endeavor is a worthwhile one, and opening up, thinking along those lines, and thinking, you know, thinking about what we can do as well as critiquing.
Oh yes, I agree with Anna. It is an interesting conclusion and a very brave one, that essentially addresses issues around social and democratic citizenship. Citizenship was historically linked to the welfare state during the mid-20th century and stood at the opposite end of market competition and profit and the inequalities of the capitalist component of society. Of course, we are living in the neoliberal, or what Colin Crouch describes as post-democratic world. Democracy has been thoroughly undermined by corporations to the point of politics itself. We're living in a world where democratic rights of citizenship have been lost. One could look at this reality in a very negative and defeating way. So in that respect, I applaud Mariana Ricci for suggesting alternatives and saying, listen, we need the critique of capitalism. And I absolutely agree. I mean, that's what we do in academia, don't we? We're revealing balanced perspectives on the ongoings in the music world, and that includes the classical music business. So in that respect, I applaud her for concluding a book in this way.
Well, thank you to all three of you for engaging so deeply with my book. I love this format for a review, and I really also appreciate the generosity you're showing in giving me some space to reflect on, you know, the fascinating conversation that you all had. There were so many ideas that arose and that you touched on, and I'll try to just speak to a few of them that resonated most strongly with me and with my own continued thinking on these topics. So both Patrick and Anna raised some questions about the way that I treat and engage with history that I found instructive. Anna spoke about my use of the term classical music and shared some thoughts about why it's important to define it as a genre. And it's true that I chose not to define it specifically in that way in the book because, as Anna noted, I was actually interested in the idea of classical music, the vague kinds of associations and images and values that congeal within it. And since my book is mostly a work of discourse analysis and culture critique, I wanted to pull apart how the idea of classical music functions, both explicitly and implicitly, within particular contemporary discourses. And so I agree that this creates a certain, to some degree, intentional blobbiness with regard to history. And classical music has a weird relationship with history, as I addressed, you know, a little bit in the book, because today it maintains some of the same specific attributes and values that also adhered to it two centuries ago, like the idea that it's more serious because it's more formally complex, or like the general ideas of abstractness and autonomy that still adhere to it. And yet also, as it has moved through history, it has collected additional values, such that now history itself, the idea of history, has also become entangled with the idea of classical music. Like simply the fact of its being old is now part of the idea, the sense meaning, or even the ideology surrounding classical music, as I discussed probably most explicitly in the final chapter on the Intel Corporation and its use of Beethoven. So the contemporary music I write about is entangled with and has to negotiate with the concept of history itself in a way that actual 200-year-old classical music wasn't and didn't. So yeah, I think my argument is particularly about contemporary classical music, although I'm interested in what this music meant in the past as well. Like Anna, I'm very interested in the ways this genre is an expression of class. And if my argument has a broader historical resonance, it has to do with the way this music has helped shape and make legible ruling class values in so many different historical and geographical contexts. So on a somewhat related note, I think Simone brought up coolness and uncoolness and kitsch. And I really love these ideas. And I would like to pursue them further at some point. Simone notes that the contemporary artists I talk about are cool. And I would say, I know what you mean, and I agree. I think that's a part of what is happening. But I'd also qualify it a bit. So, I mean, like, first of all, I'd say some of them are cooler than others, right? But then I'd also say that what they're able to do is to make appeals to a certain mode of coolness that's regulated by whiteness and class privilege and being kind of niche, right? They're, like, their lack of any really broad popularity is, I think, one of the ways they're distinguished from someone like André Rieu, who's so popular but also so uncool. Some of their detractors call them hipsters for this reason. And while I don't think that's a perfect fit, I do think that it's an instructive frame. In this sense, the mode of coolness that, like, for example, the indie classical people that I write about, the mode of coolness that they're able to tap into is actually quite similar to the mode of appeal that classical music itself functions within. So despite their claims about leaving that world behind and embracing cool pop culture and democratizing the art form, etc., they actually still operate within a milieu that's demographically similar to that of classical music in general in terms of race, class, and prestige. And they still operate within a notion of legitimacy, I would argue, that's based on being pretty exclusive with regard to actual pop culture. And I think that kind of resonates with Anna's point about how proclaiming that they're beyond genre actually situates them even more strongly within classical music, the very genre they're trying to heroically transcend by, you know, refusing the autonomous ideal and all that. So this is something I'm extremely interested in pursuing, and the observation about needing to use Bourdieu is probably correct. I know it's correct. I'm really into Marx and Adorno right now. That's the frame that I've been working with, as you correctly noted. Probably the biggest issue you all kept returning to was autonomy, and I keep returning to it myself. I've gotten more and more invested in the paradoxes and contradictions inherent in the attempt to create autonomous art or any kind of autonomous space in life or production or whatever. The great paradox of the autonomous ideal is the actually irreconcilable contradiction between individual autonomy and collectivity, between individual freedom and social freedom. I do realize that there are formulations of autonomy within the classical music tradition that reject the social outright, but part of my project, as it's developing now and as is already sort of gestured to in my book, is to investigate other ways the autonomous ideal has been constructed, both in music and in political discourses. The understanding of autonomy that I'm trying to think about art and music through derives from Adorno, as well as from classical anarchism and contemporary Black radical thought. Lately, I've been deeply inspired, for example, by Fumi Okeji's recent book on Adorno and jazz, where, among other things, she engages with the idea that music is, or maybe can be, a way of being together in the world that is at odds with the social system we're currently trapped within, and that very tension is what is potentially revelatory or liberating about music. And I think this tension is one of the things the artists in my book turn away from and reject. And it's a tension I find myself thinking of in many contexts, musical and otherwise, how to embrace the irreconcilable contradiction between individual freedom and collectivity, and what that looks like musically, as well as in every other facet of life. Patrick concluded, for example, by saying he'd like to see my critique turn towards myself a bit more and take on the academy and musicology itself. And this paradoxical difficulty is productive here as well. Fred Moten and Stefano Harney have written and spoken a lot about collective freedom as refusal within academia, how we should find ways to do the work of the job without doing the job part of the job, basically how to create spaces within the job of academia within which we collectively refuse to do our individual jobs as they're configured by the technocratic, neoliberalized, you know, university that has like its own particular mode of knowledge production that supports and upholds status quo ideologies. So basically they're interested in how we can find ways to create spaces within the job where we refuse to do our jobs, but without quitting our jobs. And it's impossible, but the insistence on doing it anyway and on expanding the spaces where others can participate in doing it as well is where freedom lives. And so, yeah, that's just kind of a woo-woo place to end upon, I guess, but that's the way that I have been continuing to think through autonomy in the years since finishing that book. And I really benefited from the conversation that you all had. And I have many more thoughts, but I'm already going on for too long. So thank you all again for such a stimulating and generous conversation. It was such a pleasure to participate.